From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Middle class, two little words that convey so much, an entire history of American hopes and dreams. The recession has battered middle class finances, but it's also shaken the country's faith in something more profound, the American dream. Today, a look at the changing fortunes and changing dreams of the American middle class.
Our system must protect our rights.
More than anything else, the Occupy Wall Street movement put a spotlight on the nation's rising income inequality. The protesters were kicked out of their headquarters at Zuccotti Park in November, but large groups continue to meet daily inside the public atrium at 60 Wall Street. Reporter Sarah Kate Kramer brings us some of their voices.
Hi, I'm Alexa O'Brien. I do consider myself to be a part, I mean, it's a fact that I'm a part of the American middle class.
My name is Craig Stallone. I'm out of work right now, so I would say that I am temporarily poor, but I have job prospects which will get me back into the middle class within another few months.
My name is Anthony Giovanni. I consider myself part of the 99% of those that live in the United States. So, yeah, I guess so.
My name is Jean. I don't consider myself part of the middle class. I consider myself to be part of the people who are in poverty.
My name is Chris. I would say that I'm somebody who grew up with many gifts. The best way for me to honor the gifts that I've received throughout my life is to fight as hard as I can and as long as I can to help as many people as possible get the same gifts that I've enjoyed.
I'm Zachary Loeb. I don't consider myself, you know, part of the middle class or part of the lower class. I just consider myself a worker.
Michael Bloss. No, I'm not a part of the American middle class. I'm homeless.
The cooperation of its members, that our system.
If there's one thing the Occupy movement has made crystal clear, it's that the American middle class is in trouble in ways this country hasn't seen for decades. But where to pin the blame? Jacob Hacker directs the Institute for Social and Policy Studies at Yale University, and he's the co-author of the book Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. He tells Steve Paulson the middle class really is the 99%.
Well, I think that most Americans believe that they're middle class. When you do polls, what you find is that about 80% of Americans say that they are middle class. And when they talk about the middle class, they mean more than just an income category. They mean a certain set of ideals, you know, the idea that if you work hard and you play by the rules, you can get ahead, that your kids will have a better life than you, that you're not living at the bottom where you have to worry about making ends meet day to day. What I want to say is that the middle class, understood as, say, everyone below the top 10% or top 1%, has clearly lost enormous ground over the last generation. As many of the sort of things we used to take for granted, like a stable pension and good health care benefits, has come under fire. And as people have started to feel as if that American dream, if you work hard and play by the rules, you'll get ahead and your kids can get ahead, is no longer perhaps as resonant as it once was.
So you're saying the middle class now is different than it was, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago?
Well, I don't think that our ideals for the middle class are that different, but I think the middle class is feeling a huge amount of strain right now. The period from the end of World War II until the 1970s featured very strong growth across the income distribution. It didn't occur automatically. There was the GI Bill that helped people go to college. There was home mortgage efforts. There was massive infrastructure development. There was investment in science and education, all of which helped create this broad middle class that had security through Medicare and Social Security and through private health insurance and pensions. Since the 1970s, something has happened, where most of the gains have gone to the very top. I mean, the numbers are really staggering. From the late 1970s until just before the Great Recession of the last few years, we saw about 40% of all household income gains go to the richest 1% of Americans. Over the last decade, it's been more than half that has gone to the richest 1%. I think that really helps explain why there's this sense that the middle class is losing ground.
So you're saying that income for the vast majority of Americans has stagnated or perhaps even dropped, let's say, over the last decade. But for that top 1%, it's shot through the roof.
That's absolutely true. We know this now far better than we did 10 or 15 years ago because of the work of a whole set of economic specialists and sociologists who have looked at income tax statistics. So the shares of income going to the very top have essentially gone through the roof. Two illustrations. In the late 1970s, roughly around 10% of income was being taken home by the richest 1% of taxpayers. In 2007, it was around 24%, which is just an enormous increase. If you look at the very top, say the top 0.1%, we're talking about the highest share in 2007 that has ever been received by that group. 1 in 1,000 households in 2007 were taking home $1 in $8 in our economy. That is a remarkable development, and we do not see it in other rich democracies. No other country has experienced that kind of massive skew toward the very top.
Hmm. You're saying there are specific political decisions that have been made that have produced this growing inequality.
Well, we know that's the case for two reasons. One is we know that the United States has been distinctive in the degree to which these broad pressures have created this massive run-up of incomes at the top, coupled with stagnant or even declining earnings in the middle and the bottom. The second reason we know this is that we can actually find the policies that matter. My favorite example here is if you think about financial deregulation, right? The Wall Street explosion was a huge aspect of the run-up of incomes at the very top. If you look at the richest 0.1% of taxpayers, about 60% are executives. Of those 60%, I think 1/3 or so is financial executives. So that's a big part of the story. And a big part of the story is capital gains and what's happened at the very top.
Can you explain that a little bit more? So you're saying that what enriched Wall Street was deregulation, specific policies that allowed Wall Street to make more money. What specifically were some of those things that were deregulated?
Well, you go back into, first of all, the lifting of a lot of restrictions on banking activities, on interest rates that could be charged, relaxation of the rules governing derivatives. And then at the same time, there was a deliberate effort across Republican and Democratic administrations not to use the enforcement tools that were in the hands of regulators. We tell a story in the book of the SEC head, Arthur Levitt, going to Phil Gramm, the Republican from Texas who was chairing the Senate Banking Committee, and saying, we really need to tighten up accounting standards. Things are getting out of hand. And this is before Enron. And what Phil Gramm said to him, I think, was sort of inadvertently prescient. He said, unless the waters are crimson with the blood of investors, I don't want you engaging in any regulatory flights of fancy. So it was there was a deliberate policy of non-interference, as well as a tearing down of a whole architecture that was designed to prevent conflicts of interest, prevent systemic risk. And that's what came home to roost with the financial crisis. So the point is that government isn't some kind of passive agent that just redistributes income after the fact. Public policies basically help create the massive boom on Wall Street that enriched so many people.
But I guess the argument on the other side is that there was a lot of money out there to be made if you deregulated. Why not loosen things up and turn Wall Street on fire, see what they could do? And why would that necessarily come back to hurt the middle class?
Actually, there's enough research now on this to suggest that countries that have very large financial sectors do not grow more quickly than other countries. There was a lot of money to be made, but who was making that money? I mean, what happened with Wall Street was basically gains were privatized among a very small circle of people, and losses were socialized across society as a whole.
Obviously, this is all highly relevant to what we're seeing with the Occupy Wall Street movement. The usual criticism of Occupy Wall Street is that there's this kind of unfocused anger, and they don't really know what they want. I mean, yes, there's rage against huge profits on Wall Street, but is there anything concrete that comes out of this? Is that a valid criticism?
It is valid criticism, but I think it misses the reality that there's a very focused critique embodied in many of the Occupy Wall Street protesters' claims. To me, the most effective slogan, the most powerful message that's come out of Occupy Wall Street is the other 99%. Right. And I just pointed out that most of the income gains of the last generation went to the top 1%. So saying the other 99% is actually pretty powerful. There is a very heavy emphasis in these protests on the fact that the 99%, particularly younger Americans who are just coming into this terrible job market, are drowning in debt, particularly college loan debt, that they don't feel that the opportunities that I talked about earlier that were embodied in the American dream are really there for them. There's a villain, and it's not just Wall Street, right? It's a sense that the political system isn't working. People who have tons of money, tons of connections are able to get what they want, but most Americans don't have that kind of influence. So I think it's actually a pretty powerful critique. That said, for these kinds of movements to have influence over the long term, they'll have to hook up with for want of a better word, elite agendas, right? There'll have to be some people who carry that message into Washington politics.
Now, it's worth pointing out that you are not just a Yale professor. You, I think, are widely considered part of the brain trust of progressive policymakers, to some degree, of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And a few years ago, the New York Times called you the intellectual it boy of the Democrats. You played a very prominent role in formulating the public option in health care. Are you saying that the Democratic Party has to distance itself from Wall Street? Does it have to some degree?
Well,
align itself with the Occupy Wall Street movement?
To some extent, yes. I think it has to distance itself. And it's being distanced whether it wants to or not. You know, Mitt Romney is pulling in more money than Obama from Wall Street. Wall Street shifted very heavily towards the Republicans in the run-up to the 2010 election.
But Wall Street was often a big ally during the 2008 election that elected
Obama. That's correct. And it was a big ally during the 1990s and 2000s when a lot of these deregulatory changes were taking place. But I think that was an unholy alliance that really hurt the Democrats' ability to present a clear and alternative vision on these economic issues. So yes, they have to distance themselves. They also have to think longer term. And if Occupy Wall Street is going to have a positive effect, I think one of the things it might do, right, is to create some organizational presence on these issues that lasts beyond one particular election campaign. I am optimistic, not for this, you know, next year or the next 2 years, but over the longer term, that there will be the development of a broader organized pressure on these issues. I think this has been such a catalyzing experience for so many people who are concerned about the shift of our country from a democracy toward an oligarchy, that there's going to be a lot of effort on a lot of fronts to try to create sustained organizational presence to push back on these issues.
Jacob Hacker is a political scientist at Yale and the co-author of Winner Take All Politics: How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
Got to find some cook who can cook my books like those Wall Street analysts and mortgage lending crooks. Lots of laws and regulations to abuse, and I'm sick to death of writing IOUs. Got those used to be in the middle class, mad as hell you can bet you're used to be in the middle class blues.
The unhappiness of the American middle class didn't appear overnight. People who knew where to look saw it coming in the heart of America, the Midwest.
Although one doesn't get the sense that there is a great deal of unhappiness behind the closed doors of Madison, I know the truth. On Fox Avenue, for instance, there's a man who wants to be a woman. On Kai's, there is a young computer programmer whose equally young wife is sleeping with a 68-year-old butcher. On Gregory Street, a financial analyst for the credit unions of North America, a man who urinates off his back deck each and every night as an assertion of some buried wildness and freedom, contemplates suicide every Sunday evening as he prepares his clothes for the work week. This man said to me, "The logistics of living wear me out, paying bills, dropping off the dry cleaning, making sure there is butter in the house. I can't seem to ever have butter or eggs in the house when I need them. I can't take it. It's too much."
Dean Bacopoulos is one of America's most gifted young writers. He teaches at Grinnell College in Iowa, and he recently published a novel called My American Unhappiness. Critics praised it as one of the funniest novels published in 2011, but it is also proving to be remarkably prescient. Before the Occupy movement drew the world's attention to widespread popular discontent, My American Unhappiness delved into America's exasperation with runaway consumerism, big institutions, and unsustainable living. Bacopoulos tells Anne Strainchamps the recession broke over his own head just after he finished the book.
I was running a small nonprofit art center in a rural town in Wisconsin, and very quickly it became clear they didn't have enough money to keep me on as artistic director. And rather than lay off the staff, I resigned. And then about 2 months later, my publisher put a halt on all new books coming out and sort of was front page New York Times, Wall Street Journal, bad news, and was my publisher. And that bad news came the day I turned in a version of this book.
was it still called My American Unhappiness?
It was. The title, I
you
guess,
must have
was
felt
prophetic.
Very prescient.
Well, I did have this feeling the whole time I was writing the book that we were approaching the precipice of something that was dangerous, that we were about to go over the edge in some way as a nation, because everything felt so unsustainable to me and so false.
Well, at the center of the novel is this idea that even during all those years of optimism and financial booms, Americans were secretly unhappy. Do you really think so?
I think that if you ask the question the way Zeke, the narrator of the book, asked the question, if you blindside somebody with a question, why are you so unhappy? They almost always have something from that day, that week, that year that's been keeping them up at night, that upset them or depressed them. You know, American unhappiness is the kind of unhappiness that comes with abundance, I think, with so many choices and so much at your disposal that you almost become paralyzed whenever it comes time to make a decision. And so that leads, I think, in America to this particular sort of overwhelmed feeling. So I think American unhappiness is unique because it does come from the very things we thought would make us happy.
Well, tell me about Zeke, your narrator. He's the director of a Midwestern Humanities Council.
Well, it's called the Great Midwestern Humanities Initiative, and it's a nonprofit government and private partnership. And he's taken on this project he calls the Inventory of American Unhappiness. And the scholarship is completely shoddy. He just goes up to people at random or through his website and asks them, why are you so unhappy? And he's always delighted to find that people often have a ready response, a quick reason, that something they've been chewing on, and it's almost as if they've been waiting to be asked.
One of the great pleasures of reading the book is that Zeke, or you, include some of the answers that people have given Zeke, and he becomes obsessed with reading, stays up late into the night reading these answers. Can you read a few?
Sure. Here's one from Abigail H., 41-year-old medical software trainer, Verona, Wisconsin. I've been unhappy since I was about 9. One day, this gray, damp January day, I remember waking up and getting upset because I had to go to fourth grade that day. And then, in one of those bizarre flash-forward moments you sometimes get as a kid, I saw the older version of myself, me, now, and I thought, there I am, getting up for work, going somewhere I don't want to go. And now, the other morning, I was dropping off my daughter Zoe, she's 4, at preschool, and I was like, oh, look at this. Here we go again. Her too. God.
You actually put some of these interviews up on YouTube as well, which I was trying to think, what should we call this, reality fiction? I couldn't actually tell whether these were real people and you walked up to them on the street with a camera crew and said, why are you so unhappy?
Why am I so unhappy? I'm 26. That means I have 50, 60 years left on a planet, running out of oil, getting hotter. I mean, I hear that, why are you so unhappy? And I just think, why shouldn't I be?
Yeah, Zeke Pappas has his own channel on YouTube now, and we have a lot of these monologues from the book have made their way into this sort of life outside the book that's still fictive but feels very much documentary style.
You know, something that just torments the hell out of me is growth. For example, they just built a brand new Cracker Barrel out by the highway. You know, do we really need another frickin' Cracker Barrel? You know, everything they build is an extra. And they spend so much money trying to make you think that you need it.
Do you think in some ways Americans also enjoy their unhappiness or their discontent? Because I was struck reading the book, you know, how quickly people respond when Zeke says, all he says is, why are you so unhappy? They're remarkably ready to lay out exactly why they're unhappy, as though it's something they've been carrying around and nurturing.
Yeah, it's true. I think that there is a culture of complaint that comes with education in a way. The more you think about things, the more you read, the more you worry about issues that are out of your control, the unhappier you get. And I think that it's probably a badge of honor in the fact that you're an engaged citizen if you're somewhat unhappy.
Well, you also suggest in the book that Americans actually prefer their presidents to be a little tortured, too.
I think so. I thought that, you know, one of the scary things about George W. Bush to me personally was just that he never seemed to be really exhausted or in a dark place. He always seemed sort of fairly peppy and raring to go, sometimes a little deer in headlights look, but ultimately he seemed pretty okay, you know, doing all right, can't complain. what I like about Obama, especially lately, is he looks pretty bad. He looks as if he stays up late at night worrying, and I think I want my president to do that. You should lose sleep as president. If you're going to take the job as president, you're giving up your 8 hours a night. You're down to 4 or 5 with a few naps if you're lucky.
Well, there's another moment in the novel I wanted to ask you about, which is when finally the full force of the financial crisis, the economic crisis, breaks. And there's a moment when Zeke, I think he finds it, that it's come almost as a relief.
Yeah. There's a kind of desperation that comes with a recession that's very scary, but it's also a little bit thrilling.
What do you mean?
Well, to be desperate for the first time in your adult life. All the things you thought were sacred, the place you lived, oh, we'll never leave this town, or we'll never leave this house, it's a great house, or we would never sell that car, or this or that, all that stuff you believe about yourself goes out the window, and you're suddenly forced to reinvent yourself. And you realize that some of the things that you'd had and some of the persona you constructed was false, and you won't miss them.
I guess I found myself thinking a little bit about a book by Parker Palmer. He's a Quaker writer.
Mm-hmm.
He's written about depression that sometimes, not always, but sometimes psychological depression can be life's way of pushing us back down to earth, grounding us. And I was wondering if you would extrapolate from that and talk about the American psyche as having been, in a way, pushed back down to earth by the economic depression.
Yeah, I think that's a great analogy. And the depression is economic in this country, but it is also emotional, because how we perceived ourselves as a strong, invincible nation with endless wealth and endless ingenuity is starting to wear off. We don't really know how to end this recession. We don't know how to bring the jobs back that we've lost. We don't seem to know how to do anything at the government level in terms of cooperation and compromise. We have two wars that we're not quite sure how to end, and that's a lot for a nation to carry around. It feels, I drove around the country a lot in the last 2 years with my family on different trips. I saw a lot of images that seemed beyond recession. It really felt like a nation in some sort of decline that we don't quite yet understand, and it's painful to see that and painful to talk about it, but it is an economic recession, but there's also something bigger happening. The decline of the middle class, the decline of a certain kind of American dream that we thought was going to be at least possible, maybe not easy, but at least possible to achieve. I think that's going away.
It sounds like you're suggesting we need a new model of happiness. Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense of what that would look like?
Well, I have a sense that our model of happiness in this country is very much based on comfort. Everything from air conditioning to exactly what we want at the grocery store, no matter what season it is, we have these comforts that fuel American happiness. And if we're going to sort of reclaim a wholeness as a nation, I think we need to learn how to put up with a little discomfort, whether it's higher gas prices, whether it's not having fresh tomatoes in January in Wisconsin. These seem like small changes, but they really do add up to a certain expectation we have for how life should be. And until you drop those expectations of how life should be, it's really hard to make any changes. We're all
talking about accepting a life with limits.
I think that's a great way of putting it. I think that, you know, when we're personally trying to make ourselves happier, if we're in some sort of funk and we're trying to get out of it, we often add something to our routine. I need more exercise. Sometimes that's true, but sometimes it's just one more thing to feel bad about not doing. I need more supplements. I need to start doing this and reading this, and I need this iPad, and I need to be able to work from home. So I'm going to make a home office and have bookshelves built. And these aren't bad things, and these aren't things that are unique to any one sort of person, but we do tend to add things when we're feeling unhappy. And I think the vision we'll have to have individually and collectively is, what can we do without? What do we not need to sustain anymore? And then try to figure out, and then what do we really need? What do we really value? How are we going to teach our children? Learning to live within limits. I think both Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals, in different ways, but in a fundamentally similar way, wanted to have life with no limits. That there would be no limit to the funding for the things we wanted, no limit to the majesty of corporate America, no limit to the university system, whatever that was the institution that we valued, that we were a part of, we thought that should have no limits. And we all have to sort of start setting those limits for ourselves, I suppose.
Dean Bacopoulos teaches creative writing at Grinnell College and is the author of the new novel, My American Unhappiness. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps. Don't forget, you can download all of our interviews and listen to them later, or share them with friends. They're all on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, could the recession have a silver lining? Depends on how you feel about a 30-hour work week and three-day weekend. Economist Juliette Shore's New American Dream, after this. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
We're talking about the decline of the middle class in this hour. First, what does being middle class mean to you?
You're not desperately poor. You, on the other hand, are not fantastically wealthy. You live a comfortable existence, perhaps not a luxurious existence, not a destitute existence, but you're comfortable.
You're more than scraping by. You've got a television. You've got a car. You go on vacation.
I guess the middle class would be the group of people who traditionally were able to own homes, send their children to higher education, retire. It's a phenomenon in the Western world that wasn't always present and is now slipping back into obscurity.
Essentially what's happened is that the factions that control our government have captured political power using financial power to pass laws to make themselves richer. And that has certainly been at the expense of the rest of the population.
As hard as middle-class people used to work to get ahead is how hard they are now working to remain at the level that they're at.
I define the middle class as the modern age slave.
Do I think the middle class is shrinking? Absolutely. I've watched it shrink.
You're either poor or rich, and there's not a real in-between.
Those are the voices of some of the protesters at Occupy Wall Street in New York. Used to be that being middle class meant you could afford a piece of the American dream. Of course, the recession has battered everyone's financial aspirations. But economist Juliette Shore says it's not just the American economy that's broken. It's the American dream. And what we really need is a new one. Shore is the author of Plenitude, The New Economics of True Wealth, and she's the co-founder of the Center for a New American Dream. Now, perhaps, like me, you're wondering what was wrong with the old one.
The American dream started out with a good vision, I think, which had to do with opportunity, hard work and opportunity, but it morphed into something which was much more about materialism and a large-size new house in a suburban development, late model SUVs, high levels of material consumption, and that's not ecologically sustainable. And it also has proven to be economically difficult in a world in which it has been increasingly a small fraction of people who can afford that kind of lifestyle. So it's beginning to feel more and more unattainable to people.
The American dream we've all believed in, you're saying, was based on essentially the economics of more, and we need an economics of less?
We need an economics of enough. And I think one of the things that happened is by focusing so much on more and not thinking enough about more of what, we ended up on a kind of treadmill to nowhere in which the race to get all those things became pernicious in itself. People had to work longer and longer hours. They had to take on more debt. We became a society of more and more inequality and less cooperation and community.
I actually like the use of the word enough, because it sounds like what you're saying is we need to redefine ourselves. And defining ourselves as achieving less doesn't sound very positive. It sounds small. It sounds uncomfortable, frankly. Enough, well, maybe that is enough.
Yes, and in fact, my most recent book is titled Plenitude, because what I want to get across to people is a life which decenters material acquisition in the way we've thought about it, and which reorients us toward community and social ties, toward living in balance with nature, toward having sane schedules where people actually have free time. Those are forms of wealth which will actually give us more well-being than more material goods in that endless quest.
Well, so how do we redefine this? Because the problems we're facing, I mean, the big one is unemployment right now, for instance. A lot of people have stopped even looking for a job because they don't believe there's ever going to be a job for them. How do you deal with, well, a problem like unemployment? How do you find more jobs?
I think the biggest thing that we need to do is to adjust working hours. Since the 1970s, the U.S. has increasingly devoted its productivity growth to expanding the economy. And what this meant is that we stopped getting increases in free time, reductions in working hours. In contrast to Europeans and Japanese, who began to get longer vacations, shorter weekly hours of work, more days off per year. So, for example, one of the kinds of things that I think we should be doing is hiring new people on 80% schedules so we can gradually move toward a four-day work week and a three-day weekend, something that makes a lot of sense in a country where you have large numbers of dual-earner families, for example.
For every five people who go to an 80% schedule, there's one more job? Is that the idea?
Exactly. Now, what it means is that those people who get hired at, let's just be simple about it, 80% of the salary that they might have gotten if they were on a 100% job. But what we know about income in wealthy countries is that what matters most is comparative position. So if everyone is going to 80% eventually, the whole status game, the whole increasing norms of consumption gets slowed down and people get more free time and less pressure to ratchet up their lifestyle.
What about the other side of the equation? How likely is it that employers will be interested in this? Because frankly, what we've seen is reduction in the number of people and an increase in the number of hours that they are expected to work, isn't it?
Absolutely. So the employer side has been difficult for reasons of accident in part, which is that a lot of the benefits that employers pay in this economy are paid on a per person basis. And the most expensive of those is health care. And that's an accident, because the reason we have health care being provided by employers is that during the Second World War, when there were wage and price controls, employers who wanted to pay more to their workers weren't able to through straight wage increases. And so one of the ways they got around it was by starting to offer them other benefits, for example, health insurance.
So how would you deal with it? If you start having people work 80%, would you also give them 80% of the health care benefits?
There are a lot of ways to go on this. You could have the government subsidize that 20% to begin with. It could give incentives to firms to hire on this 80% schedule. You could also make available lower cost plans for people. That's what the public option does. I mean, ultimately, single payer or any other health care regime that gets health care out of the employment relationship will solve this problem.
Can you really segue onto a different path like this? Because there are multiple things that have to change. It's not just a matter of the government deciding or the individual deciding or the business deciding. Everybody has to kind of get together and agree on a different American dream.
Yes and no. I mean, I think there are things you can do at the policy level, and there are also changes that can be taking place at a sort of population or household level that can move you to there more or less gradually. So I look at the example of the Netherlands, where I lived in the 1990s. In the early 80s, they had very high unemployment. All of Europe, Western Europe, was suffering a big negative shock, as we call it in economics, to employment. The government responded by deciding to make its labor market very flexible and to put more of these short schedules in. So, for example, all new government employees went on 80% schedules. Eventually, the whole Dutch financial sector went on to 80% schedule.
The whole Dutch financial?
Yes.
So banks and investment firms went to 80%?
4-day work weeks. Yep. It sounds kind of crazy almost in the era that we've just come through. But, you know, American working schedules are really quite different than schedules in other places. And the average Dutch employee today is working about 1,340 hours a year in comparison to places like the United States, where we're more like 1,700-1,800. They also have extremely low unemployment and been the most productive labor force in Europe over this period. That's another great thing that shorter hours do. It makes the hours that people do work much more productive. So,
is there evidence to suggest what these people are doing with the extra time that they have?
They have a more traditional gender division of labor, so they do tend to do a lot of things that in America we buy on the market, whether it's making costumes for their kids, arts and crafts, do-it-yourself renovations, and that sort of thing. They also take very long vacations. They have many weeks of vacation. When I lived there, I had 8 weeks of vacation paid. And not only that, in your June paycheck, you get an extra month's of pay. So you get double pay in June. They've held out some salary all during the year so that you have extra money to go on vacation. The other thing is they spend a lot of time with family. Sunday is a big family day. So they have a high level of friend and family interaction. So they've really managed to hold on to a lot of that community that many Americans are so hungry for.
You talk around the country about this. What kind of reaction do you get from people when you give those talks?
For the most part, I would say people are very enthusiastic or open to the idea that we need to do something different in this country, that we need a new kind of economy, we need a new American dream. However, there is also a climate of a sort of certain opinion that says it's impossible, we could never do that. We could never have shorter hours in this country, or companies will never do this. So there's a mantra about the impossibility of change that many people still hold. I would say since the downturn, and even more since the Occupy movement, that is a less powerful voice.
Juliet Shore is an economist and sociologist at Boston College. She's the co-founder of the Center for a New American Dream. Her new book and her blog are called Plenitude, The New Economics of True Wealth.
Mama, economy, make me understand all the numbers. Why daddy's on a welfare plan, turning 30, 40, 50, gotta move in with my parents, and the stocks go up, but the jobs disappear.
What's your vision of the American dream? Join the conversation on our Facebook page. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's not just the American middle class that's in trouble. Take a look around the world. Greece, Italy, Iceland, Ireland. They all used to have prosperous middle classes, like us. Their financial bubbles popped first. And now, well, financial writer Michael Lewis calls them the new third world. Lewis is one of the few writers who can make you laugh out loud about financial disaster. No wonder his books are so popular. He's the author of Moneyball, The Blind Side, Liar's Poker, and now Boomerang. Steve Paulson couldn't get one of the characters in the new book out of his head.
Your new book, Boomerang, starts with a story about someone you met while you were actually researching your last book, The Big Short, a hedge fund manager named Kyle Bass. Why did he interest you?
Well, he's the one who dragged me into this story. I was interested in him in the first place because he was one of a handful of money managers who had made a fortune off the collapse of the subprime mortgage bond market. And he'd lost interest in the subprime mortgage bond market because he'd moved on to what he said was the next crisis, which was the sovereign debt crisis. And he painted a scenario for me that was perfectly terrifying, but that basically said the bad debts that have been accumulated in these incontinent years are being basically assumed by governments, and the governments aren't going to be able to support the debt, and governments are going to fall.
And he'd simply crunch some numbers, didn't he? I mean, looking at the amount of debt that was accumulated and the amount of revenue coming in, and this guy seemed to think there's no way these countries could survive.
He made one big assumption, which at that time nobody else was making, and the assumption was the debts of the big banks are effectively now government debts. The governments have decided they're going to backstop the banks. They're not going to let the banks fail, so they're going to assume these debts. And if you add those debts to the debts the countries were already running, which were high, and compared that to their revenues, their tax revenues, you could see that some of these countries really couldn't sustain the debt they'd taken on.
Okay, this kind of makes sense. I mean, it would seem to, and yet most of Wall Street, at least a couple of years ago, thought this hedge fund manager was dead wrong.
He was able to place bets against, for example, the government debt of Greece. He was making essentially a bet that its bonds would default. And to make this bet, he had to pay fractions of a percentage point. Pay a dollar and make 700, basically. But there's a reason for this. The notion of defaults of putatively affluent Western countries was preposterous until recently. And so the whole idea of sovereign default is a little strange because, you know, Greece, it's not going to, it turns out, he's right, it's not going to repay its debts. But it's as much a matter of willingness as ability. And it's a political judgment as much as an economic judgment.
Now, when you say that, of course, Greece is not going to repay its debt, why is that so obvious? Don't they have to repay their debt?
Well, they've already cut a preliminary agreement with the IMF and the European Union to repay only a fraction of the monies that it owes its bondholders. The bondholders have already tentatively agreed to take some losses on Greek government bonds. It's a question of how much.
Well, let's talk about the problems in Greece, because at least the way you write about it, it's kind of mind-boggling how Greece got into such a mess. Tell me the problem here.
Well, the basic cause of all these national debt problems was that the financial markets made very cheap credit available to countries and people and companies without thinking too much about the risk. And Greece borrowed lots of money, the government borrowed lots of money, to bloat an already bloated state. And the Greek problem is at the root of it, really, is the relationship between the Greek people and the Greek government. They regard the government essentially as an entity to plunder. There are lots of government jobs that aren't real jobs. The Greek people get paid to be employed by the government, but actually not do very much.
Well, and you say that the average salary for a government job is nearly three times as much as the private sector jobs.
Yes. I mean, you take one example, and it's a colorful example, but it's pretty representative. The Greek National Railroad is a government-owned railroad, has 100 million euros of revenue a year and pays out 400 million euros in salary every year. And the average employee of that railroad is paid 65,000 euros a year to work for it, which is more than the average employee of any private sector Greek company. So the government is regarded as it's kind of like a piñata that the Greek people can take wax at and get their goodies out of. And on the other side of it is They don't pay taxes. It's not part of the culture to pay taxes. Tax avoidance is the norm. I mean, you sit down with, as I did, with great tax collectors, and they will tell you that the quickest way to get fired as a tax collector is to be too aggressive about collecting taxes. That it's acceptable, for example, to take bribes from people not to collect their taxes, but not acceptable to be too aggressive in pursuing them.
Well, you also interviewed the Greek finance minister, and I have to say your account of that meeting reads almost like a comedy skit as he was explaining the depth of the problem. Can you describe what he was talking about?
Well, that was the Greek finance minister who stepped down just a couple of months ago because the problem he found was too intractable. Because actually, he was being blamed for implementing the demands of the European Union and the IMF and trying to collect taxes. He said the financial problems were much, much worse than anybody imagined. The deficit was much, much, much worse than anybody imagined because none of the taxes were collected. The tax collectors were taken off the streets. And I said, what do you mean? He says, well, it was an election year. In the election year in Greece, the party in power knows not to have the tax collectors out there at all. I said, oh my God. And he says, and when I got here, I said, I tried to round up all the different departments and figure out what we actually owed people. And it took a matter of a couple of weeks, and people were coming out of the woodwork saying, oh, here's another couple of billion euros that we haven't mentioned. And Greek people would tell you this unabashedly. They'd say, you know, everybody here cheats on taxes. Everybody here abuses the government jobs. It's just part of life here. And changing that is very hard.
Well, because the obvious response is you have to collect more taxes and you have to cut back on government spending. And yet when this was proposed, riots broke out in the streets.
Riots are breaking out on the streets right now, and they're getting worse. And they're getting worse because it's an entitlement culture. People assume that the individual Greek is being asked to change his way of life. It was very telling that one of the things that has protesters on the streets and has caused the Greek government's popularity ratings to sink to all-time lows is that the Greek government forced through a new tax. They really are trying to collect the taxes now, but they found it impossible to collect them the old-fashioned way. And they've pushed through a new property tax in which Greeks aren't billed the way you and I are billed for our property taxes because it's just assumed they'd cheat on them if they did it that way. It's being billed as an add-on to their electric bills. And they're being told that if they don't pay it, their electricity's cut off. But the way this thing has been playing out, the natural next step is all of a sudden you find the Greeks aren't paying their electric bills and mysteriously the lights remain on. I mean, they've been unbelievably elusive.
Now, these are fascinating stories, I have to say, kind of incredible stories. I do wonder how much this has to do with our own economic problems here in the United States. Is there a connection here? I mean, other than the fact that, you know, when we hear bad news about Greece, then the Dow tumbles. Is there a more direct connection than that?
There is a much more direct connection than that. The first connection is that if Greece goes belly up and doesn't repay French and German banks what it owes, then the people who are owed money by French and German banks who are intertwined with those banks' activities are going to be suspect. And American banks are exposed to those banks. So the American financial sector comes under attack in the markets. To me, the most interesting sort of connection between these European stories and America, though, is cultural. We did a number of things. We had a land bubble. We inflated our financial sector crazily. We also inflated our public sector crazily, especially at the level of the municipality. Public employee unions cut deals with states and cities that are going to, in some cases, bankrupt cities. So in a funny way, we kind of did it all. But if you wanted to sort of generalize about what the problem was in America that was exposed by this money event, it was that we seem to have got to a point where we're almost blind to the long-term interests of the society because we're excessively focused on a lot of short-term interests. And the short-termism of American life was really brought to the surface by the money.
I want to turn the tables a little bit and ask about you and how you do this kind of reporting.
Because I'm so interesting.
Well, right? I mean, you seem to, it's almost as if you're some cross between anthropologist and amused spectator. And obviously, you're good at sniffing out the money trail. How would you describe what you do?
I think of myself as pretty simply as just a writer, but I do a lot of just wandering around. So had long lists of people to go talk to, interviewed all kinds of people, and starting at the top, you know, I could go see, in some cases, the head of state, and certainly the finance minister. But I would tend to go in with no great preconceived notion. It's usually some question, like, how come Greek people who borrowed all this money and aren't going to pay it back are the ones who are most outraged in Europe? I usually have some crude question I'm trying to answer, but I don't have much of a method. It really is sort of drifting towards the material that gets me jazzed. Hmm.
So a lot of it is who you happen to run into. I mean, it might not be some famous or important person, but the man on the street can give you some answers.
Yes, I do think you can learn a lot more about people and societies by looking at the parts of them that don't think are being examined. So if I were sitting with you and I was trying to decide what kind of guy you were, and I had to do it really quickly, I wouldn't pay much attention to, say, what you did with your hair or your face, because you yourself would be very self-conscious about that. But I might look at your fingernails, something you didn't think I was looking at. So with Greece, this is going to sound odd, but I had some social pressure to go write about the prime minister. He heard I was in town, and I kind of think he wanted me to write a profile of him. But the prime minister is, you know, he's going to be perfectly groomed. He's your hair. On the other hand, if you can find a couple of Greek tax collectors that no one's ever talked to, that's the dirt under the fingernails. That's how I went about it.
Michael Lewis, talking with Steve Paulson. Lewis is the author of Moneyball, Liar's Poker, and The Big Short. His latest is called Boomerang, Travels in the New Third World. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Want to know more about something you heard in this hour? Want to hear it again? Or share an interview with someone else? Visit our website at ttbook.org. You'll find links, book and music listings, and lots more interviews. If you want to purchase an actual CD copy of this hour, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for The Decline of the Middle Class. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by N-Strain Champs, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, Charles Monroe Kane, and Sarah Nix. In New York, reporter Sarah Kate Kramer brought us the sounds of Occupy Wall Street. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.